Good morning. I'm David Rhodes, President of the United States Psychotronics Association. This is a technical session of the 1980 conference at Bergamo Retreat in Dayton, Ohio. Welcome, all of you, and welcome to our videotape audience. Our speaker of this session, Colonel Thomas E. Bearden, retired from Huntsville, Alabama, is another of the American deans of psychotronics. His technical background, formally, is in nuclear engineering. He's currently employed by a major aerospace firm. Tom is editor of the meta-science publication Specula, published by the American Association of Meta-Science. His subject this morning is mind and matter interaction. Tom?
Thank you, David. Fellow members of the U.S. Psychotronics Association, and ladies and gentlemen, I would like to talk this morning on the mind and matter, the nature of each of those two words and what it represents, and also the interaction between the two. In so doing, I will be forced to go to the absolute limit of present physical theory and somewhat beyond. So it's going to be a pretty far-flung trip, but we're going to make it as simple and hopefully as interesting as we can. And hopefully we will be able to give you a few new concepts to put in your lexicon to think about reality, or what you perceive to be reality. As a matter of fact, I hope to convince you that reality is quite different from anything you have ever seen. But I want to be specific. I hope to also convince you of the nature of what causes you not to see reality. On the slide that lists the subject, we represent a great dinosaur-like beast cuddling the world beneath his front forelegs. That is a symbolic drawing. The beast represents the great collective human unconscious, and I will add the word mind. It is a mind. I take the step that the Jungian shudders at taking. And if it is a mind, it is a living entity. And towards the ends of the lecture, we will give you some insight into the nature of that fantastic entity of which you and I and all of us are parts. And if I could have some help with the slides, please. Could someone please shuffle my slides? I'm nailed to this microphone and can't move. At any rate, we will be proceeding through much of the advanced material which I have in my forthcoming book, which I should have on the next slide, if I can have it, please. The Excalibur briefing, which after 2.5 years, I'm really finally going to get out. Honest fellows, it's really true. All of the material I am speaking of today, and a great deal more also, will be in this book published by Strawberry Hill Press, and it will be out in September, about a month from now. Could I have the next slide, please? If I can have some help with the slides, please. There we go. Part of what I'm talking about will have a great deal to do with future prospects for science and humanity. This is a chart with a list of some of those processes and prospects. And all of them, I assure you, are in the immediate offing, if we but look at where science has gone today. And I'm going to try to share with you a vision of exactly where it is pointing. Everything on that slide from free energy, which you will hear a real nice talk by John Morey to prove to you that that has indeed been done and has been done many years ago. Everything from that to actual teleportation through space-time is possible, including superluminal communication. That too is possible. It is embedded in the present theory. I will not be addressing superluminal communication. The final evolution of mankind is also, I am quite convinced, at hand, and I will give you the precise nature of that step in evolution for the human species and exactly how it will occur. Next slide, please. There is in the mind and in the head of every human being who has ever lived and walked on the face of this earth for the last 4 to 5 million years of human evolution a single delusion. The nature of that delusion is quite specific. Primitive man saw his surroundings and saw the reality he was immersed in by means of the photon interaction. The photon interaction changes fundamental reality. When light is reflected from an object specifically, it takes and carries away time. It tears away the fourth dimension. If you do not believe me, check the equations of the photon interaction. The only thing in this universe which has time physically is the photon. It is the carrier of time, and therefore one should not be too surprised to find that time flows at the speed of light, since that is its carrier. But it leaves behind it a spatial or three-dimensional world. Look around you. What is this mysterious time you speak of? You have never seen it. You have never touched it. You have never tasted it. And from quantum mechanics, we can assure you that it is not measurable by any instrument. There is no such thing as a clock. And that is rigorous physics. There has been no such thing as a clock, and there will never be such a thing as a clock. It is not possible to measure or detect time or time change. We always infer that. We may infer it very precisely, but it is inference nonetheless. What I'm saying to you is because you operate behind a physical sensory system, your body and your senses, the interaction with the light that comes to you changes the reality you live in and leaves the partial reality you experience. You are asleep. I am asleep, and we all are asleep, and so has been every human being who has ever walked on the face of the earth, quite rigorously, and I'm talking physics, not mysticism. We can, however, escape the limitation to the partial reality we think we live in, because that's the one we detect, by simply realizing the nature of the detection mechanism and realizing what it is there before the detection occurs. And that is ultimate or fundamental reality. I'm not going too deep into that, but I'm going to give you a little hint because there are some technical people in the crowd or in the audience. If you look in front of your eyes between you and the next object you can see, you think you are looking at empty space. You are not. You are looking at space-time, because that nothingness which you think you cannot see or see, whichever you prefer, your words fail, you think of as existing in time. It is space-time, and that is the reality. If time is connected back to a physical object, you cannot see it because it disappears from your detection system. which can only be spatial. I'll leave it at that point. Next slide, please. We have on this slide a fundamental model of physical objective reality. This is what causes it. This is what generates it. And this is what is the great delusion. As a matter of fact, it fits something called the Fermi model or the raindrop model of nuclear fission, a perfect example. If I have what I think is a three-dimensional object, and I have what I think of as a photon coming in to hit it and be absorbed, at the instant of being absorbed, the photon connects that extra dimension it's carrying, that time dimension, to the object. And that object now becomes not three-dimensional, but four-dimensional. It is not mass at this point, but it is mass-time. It is not object, but object-time. There is an extra multiplication by another dimension, dimensionally speaking. At the next instant, another photon is re-emitted from the object, and it tears off and carries away that time tail, leaving behind it a three-dimensional object. And the only thing we can ever detect with our instruments is that three-dimensional thing that remains. And from the last such detection of a three-dimensional change, we compare the two then. And if they are different, we say that physical change has occurred. The thing has changed its position, its weight, its mass, something else like that. If we find no difference, we say it has not changed. I wish to point out to you that the comparison back to the first interaction is possible only in the mind. Change occurs one quantum at a time, and quanta do not superpose. The physical world you think you detect does not exist, and this is rigorous physics, and this is where quantum physics has carried us. At any one instant of time in the universe, the only thing which exists is one quantum change just in the process of occurring. Everything else is gone. There is no length, there is no time, there is nothing of any of the things that we delude ourselves about. If we assemble in our minds a great assemblage of those instantaneous one-at-a-time jumps, that constitutes what we see around us as physical reality. Now, you don't have to worry about the great delusion. It's going on for you all the time, because every object in this world has temperature, and that's the continual absorption and emission of photons. And so everything in the world is continually doing this for you. I am reminded of the beginning of Genesis in the Christian Bible. When the creation was first made, there was no form, that is, there was no spatiality. And then God said, let there be light, and then there was form. Someone long ago knew what I have just told you from this podium. Perhaps in different terms, but he knew it nonetheless. Next slide, please. On this slide, we try to deal a little bit again with fundamental reality. We show one quantum, and the universe is made or composed or generated by something called action. Energy times time, not energy. There's no such thing independently as energy. And one little, from this nothingness, a single hunk of it is carved out. A certain size nothingness brick, if you will, that we call a quantum of action. And that quantum then must be split or broken apart, or technically fissioned, to yield two different things. Now that is perception. At that point, you have detection, physical detection. If you snap it apart so that you have energy and time, you are dealing with energy and time, and you have a little time jump. You can regard it as being snapped apart into momentum and length, and then you have momentum in a physical object. And all physical systems we know exhibit this effect. So far, quantum physics is in perfect agreement with me. Now, let us take the step that quantum physics does not take. If you visualize by analogy breaking a brick and sitting with the two pieces of the brick in your hand, then how are you going to reach for the next brick? You've got your hands occupied. To get rid of the pieces, you must stick them back together, at which place they once again become nothingness action, empty vacuum, and that will disappear them. What you have done, if you can see by the slide, is you have taken that little piece of positive time that you suddenly created when you split the first quantum action atom, and you have now put it back. That is a negative time operation. And I told you that was what the photon does. The production of the first piece of time was a photon emission. The absorption or carrying away of that little piece of time is the photon emission. Photon emission. And so what we really have is that light is an oscillation of time. Or if you prefer, time is an oscillation of light. Doesn't matter. In the electromagnetic wave, what is actually oscillating is time. For the technicians in the audience, if you don't hear anything else, please hear this. The top part, the positive part of the sine wave, of the electromagnetic wave, is indeed positive time, and that is given by the interaction with the electron. The negative part of the sine wave is indeed in the opposite time sense, and that is given by the positron. And so if you have a wave with enough energy in it, you can break it in two, break it in half, and what you will get will be a positron and an electron in the observable state. They'll be big enough to stay around and hang around for a while, and that is pair production. Next slide, please. One other thing on the slide, this mechanism yields a fundamental new mass definition formula, quite rigorous, from which one may derive, for example, the second or the square law of gravitation. On this slide, stay with me, the going on the front's a little heavy, and we'll get to the interesting stuff. On this slide, I show something else which has been totally obscured in relativity because it's very embarrassing, but it is true nonetheless, and Einstein himself pointed this out on several occasions, and of course, the top foundations of physics guys today know it. They don't know what to do with it, but they know it. What we call velocity is in fact nothing in the world but rotation outside of this spatial frame in a higher dimensional sense. It's a measure of rotation. The Lorentz transforms, I show the simple ones on the slide. I'm not going through that. You can read the slide if you wish later. The Lorentz transforms merely prescribe how much rotation has occurred. That's all. It is not mass, you see, which increases. It's the amount of force that you're able to get onto the object which is turning out of your world. If you have a force in your world, it only has a projection onto the object. And so as the object is moving, it's turning away from your force, and the dot product is what it has to operate on. And less of your force can get on the object, and you think that thing is getting a lot harder to push, and it isn't at all. It's just that you ain't in the right place to push. Like the Cajun says. And all that the speed of light is a perfect right angle turn, and that dude loses one dimension when it does that. It's been shortening along its line of motion in its intersection in our world, and it has turned one turn away from our world. That's all it is. And that's all a photon is, an electron that's flipped one turn and killed one of its physical dimensions in its intersection with you. So therefore, it's now moving at the speed of light. See, and it has only two dimensions, orthogonal to the line of direction, and hey, baby, that's a photon. A wave front, transverse wave front, moving along with the velocity v equal to c in empty space. And if you flip that dude back, it turns right back into some old mass. So this is the basic interaction in the world that we deal with in physics. The thing flipping one turn out into electromagnetic, which we call energy, and flipping back. Now, this is not written in your textbook. All that energy is the outside of this world projection component. Energy is a measure of how much of it is hanging out of this world. And when it ain't got no energy that it's kinetic energy that it's exhibiting, it's all back in this world. It's not turned out any. And all that a photon is one that's flipped one of its dimensions completely out of this world. Next slide, please. Unfortunately, before I leave right here, physics stopped at that point. They had a good thing going with the Lorentz transforms, and they got tired of counting. They stopped at four. Minkowski put together a four space, and that killed everything. I want you to think of it this way. Nobody knows what a dimension is. If you pursue what the word dimension means, you find ultimately it only means fundamental variable. It has no other content. There is no such thing as a dimension per se. That dimension is made from the spin of the object and the swirl and the photon interaction and the fissioning and fusioning of action quanta. It has no fundamental existence. In case that tears you up, we'll show you a new kind of physics later on that's gobbling up all of physics today, and it starts where there is no space and time. Space and time originate naturally in that theory from spinning things. At any rate, what I wanted to leave with you was the fact that why should you stop with one turn, visualize an infinite dimensional space, and turn as many times as you wish away? Aha, when you do, you can couple everything. You can get the mind. You can get neutrinos and find out what they are. You can find out what the virtual photon really is. You can get superluminal communication. And I'll show you that the world does communicate superluminally with itself. And so forth. And that's what we're going to chase down and find out. Because, would you believe it, that's the only way we can capture the mind. And that's the only way we can explain psychotronics. I'm going to explain to you how a Hieronymus device actually works, for example, when I get through here. Next slide, please. Oh, this one is next. Much of what I say can be proven and clearly established from the two-slit experiment, which is a very embarrassing thing, but it contains the heart of all quantum mechanics, the only mystery of quantum mechanics according to Feynman, and it has no classical explanation at all. Young's experiment done with an electron here, which I'm showing, if you emit the electron from an emitter, inside a box with two little slits in the wall tuned down to the electron's frequency, the de Broglie wave frequency. And if you have a screen to collect the electron hits, if you visualize the electron's a little baseball, a little three-dimensional thing, it ought to go through one hole and one hole only, a little ricochet off the edges, so a little scatter around one point. And on the slide, I show what the classical expectation is. A little blob from those that are collected going through one hole, another little blob down on the other side from those going through the other hole. That ain't what you get at all. Instead, you get something that looks like a wave diffraction problem. You get a lot of blobs. Now, they couldn't believe that, so they set up a photon gun in there, and they hit that dude with a photon on while it was on the way to mark where it was. We're going to check you out, buddy, that electron. And when they hit it with a photon, the electron then produced the classical distribution. And it doesn't matter where you hit it before it gets to the box slits or after it gets to the two-slit region, it still gives you the classical distribution. Oh, boy, we didn't have any kind of logic that would deal with that. How could a thing be in two places at once? So we very learnedly began to talk of the wave nature of matter and all kinds of things like that. I'm going to tell you what really goes on in there. It's real simple. When an electron is born out of space-time, space-time is four-dimensional, not three. That dude is a four-dimensional hunk of junk when it's first carved out, before you chop it apart by fissioning the action atom. And so you have a ghostly nothingness electron, which is because it's four-dimensional and it's built out of space-time, not space. It is not a hard little baseball. And it's on its way towards those two-slit regions. And it's got a whole nother dimension. And time, you see, is the only thing that things can occupy multiply. You can't occupy the same space at the same time, but you can occupy the same time at the same time. It's the only dimension. That's the nature of time, multiplicity. You deep theoreticians, think on that a while. That'll stir your head bone, like the Cajun says, if you ponder it long enough. And so in that dimension, that electron hits both holes because they're space-time holes. I told you empty space was not space, but space-time. And you know the holes have a little different nature now than the normal scientist thinks about them as. They're existing in time, so they are four-dimensional hole times. And it hits both of them and interacts with both of them, and you get the wave diffraction pattern. If you then come in with your little photon gun and you whack that thing on the head and you tear off its little time tail when the photon is re-emitted from as it collides with the electron, you convert it to a three-dimensional object, to a little hard baseball, and now it can only go through one hole, and that's what you get. And I have just explained something to you that no physicist in this world, according to Richard Feynman, Nobel Prize winner, co-founder of the single most successful physics theory, quantum electrodynamics, says nobody understands. And I've just explained to you the dimensionality. Charles Muses understood it and thought it was so simple he kept going. In 1957, he said, there's no mystery to this experiment at all if one considers the time aspects. Only he didn't use the word time. He used chronotopological. Chrono meaning time, topological meaning three-dimensional space. Next slide, please. But what I have told you with that simple-minded little slide is that the single most fundamental experiment in all of quantum mechanics today proves exactly what I told you about space-time and space being torn out of it by the photon interaction. That's what that experiment shows. I don't have too much time to dwell with this, and let me pass to the next slide directly. I want to correct fundamental logic, because the logic we use, the three laws, the first three on the next slide here, according to Aristotle, are simply the synthesis and the fitting to the photon interaction. They are the fitting to the reality that emerges in the partial world that we must live in after it's been interacted with by light. And so any time the three-law logic is hung on the board, implicit and assumed in those three statements are the fact that the photon interaction must have occurred. Well, we know from the quantum two-slit experiment, we get a much different kind of reality when the photon interaction has not occurred. Let's see what happens in logic when you don't have the photon emission. But I'm going to make first the correction to the logic, because this is the first fundamental correction to logic itself, the foundations of logic in 3,000 years, and it's on the slide looking at you this morning. Now, all mathematics, all science, all physics, all electromagnetic theory, everything known in the left brain, Western world, is founded and fitted to those three laws of logic. And if we change those, we change the entire structure of it all, every single bit of it. And that's what we're going to do. We are going to follow Charles Muses' hint that logic is not spatial, but it can be spatio-temporal, chronotopological. We're going to add back in the missing fourth dimension as follows. Suppose I look at this gentleman here. Bang, one snapshot. That's all I'm going to get. And then the next snapshot, bang, I look at something else. Now I'm going to number the snapshots, because it took a little piece of time to take that snapshot, to see him, to detect him with my instruments or with my mind, which occupies time too. We're speaking either mental perception or physical detection. They both occupy time. If I am looking at him in time snapshot one, I am not looking at somebody else. I'm looking at either at him and him only. In snapshot two, I don't know yet whether that was him. I just know I got a detection. I recall from my memory what I had in time snapshot one, and I take what I have in my memory from time snapshot two, and I compare them together. This is a different time interval three. Now, I perform a set of logical operations, and really what I do is I compare them. I go down by the shape of his nose, color of his hair, color of his eyes, how his forehead is. Is he getting bald like me? Does he wear a beard like me, etc., etc.? If the other one matches every single thing, I get zeros every time I subtract those things. The absence of all distinction is the definition of identity. I then declare that time snapshot number two is identical to time snapshot number one. It isn't in time at all. It's a different time. But it is spatially the same. Now, we do that so fast and so automatically, we don't even realize we do it. We do it almost instantaneously at blinding speed with our minds. But we do it nonetheless. Now, what I have said is that inside time interval 3, a whole host of operations, an algorithm, if you will, is hidden and covered up by that operational symbol, identical or not identical, too. There's a great deal of assumptions in there. And that's never been even taken into account in logic. We are now speaking of chronotopological logic, not topological logic. Now we're going to do a thought experiment. Suppose that I took whatever that thing you think of was as time snapshot 1, and whatever this thing was as time snapshot 2, and I meld them together. It's just like taking two slides, putting them in a slide projector both at the same time. You're going to get one flash of light through the slide projector on the screen. One more snapshot, that's all. Bang. You get one object. Do you know anything about an A1 and a not A2 inside that object? No, you're not permitted to make those kinds of separations. You're going to look at that snapshot you got and nothing else. Can you say that is A and only A? Nope. Can you say that it is not A? Nope. Because the normal things, statements you make do not apply. They apply only to monocular, one-at-a-time observation. I forced upon you binocular observation, and I won't allow you to separate it. I'm going to now say to you that in time interval 3, if I force those conditions on you, if you accept them, you have absolutely no mechanism or means to make any distinguishment between what had been A in time 1 and what had been not A in time 2, and I have just told you how exact opposites can be identified and are. Every boundary in the universe is such a binocular identification. I'm going to prove that to you. Take a cube in deep space, empty vacuum. You stand inside the cube. You gather every bit of that thing, the cube, that you can find. When you get every bit of it, you didn't leave out any, you're going to be right on the boundary of it. You can collect every piece of that boundary and find that it all, in fact, belongs to thing. Since the whole of the sum of its parts, you now can prove conclusively by three-law logic that that boundary is totally composed of thing and thing only. Now you're going to come stand outside that dude, and you're going to look at that same boundary and look at all the space around and get all the empty space. When you get it all, you're going to crank up to the boundary. You can collect every single piece of that boundary, and you can claim that each and every piece of it belongs to empty vacuum, and so you can now prove by three-law logic that the surface is nothing but empty boundary, empty space. But by binocular vision, we stand back and look through both of those guys' eyeballs, and we swear that the thing is equal to itself, and so you just find that thing and non-thing can be precisely identical. It only depends on the conditions of the observation. But when I say thing and non-thing are identical, I have always implied binocular detection, not monocular. Now, this is important enough, I'm going to hit you again. In logic, we know that some things in the world are not logical. Nature didn't follow our limited photon interaction. She does some other things as well. She doesn't just have one act, so to speak. And so as we look around us in reality, we find many things which fit three-law logic. They are spatial or can be spatially represented. We find many other things which cannot be represented that way and therefore are totally illogical. Now, I'm a dumb Cajun. If you tell me you got three laws and you got two kinds of cases, the cases that those laws cover and the cases they don't, I'm going to say, man, you ain't got no problem, you logicians, because if I write the negative of each one of those laws, I'm going to cover that other case you got when they don't hold. It turns out one law does that. A is identical to not A. A1 is not identical in time 3 to what was seen as not A in time 2. Now, I want to point out to you the final closure of the logic, that in the logic operation previously assumed in time 3 for the ordinary logic, we were forced to use manipulations involving both objects at the same time, both perceptions. In time 1 and time 2, we took those and used them in time 3, and that's binocular. And so now the logic becomes rigorously clear. In the world that we live in reality, what we have is this kind of situation. The three laws apply explicitly and the fourth is implicit, hidden. Or the fourth is explicit and the three are implicit, hidden. And there's no longer any contradiction. But just in case that didn't hit your head bone, I'm going to prove to you that you can identify opposites. Next slide. I hope that one's next. If the colors look right, it's next. In one snap of your fingers, you can prove that everything the logicians have previously done is wrong, or limited. It's not wrong. It just had a limit. And here's the limit removed. We use these little Venn diagrams. They do things on flat planes, and they don't ever allow you to move the plane. They don't ever change the topology. And we use a Venn diagram. On the left, we call it A. On the right, little rectangle there, we call that not A. Using a two-value logic. Only now, I'm going to allow you to rotate the doggone Venn diagram. We're going to lift up the right side, and we're going to fold it right back on the other one. And you're going to be sitting and looking at one frame in time three now, in which you have folded the thing you saw as A in time one and the thing you saw as not A in time two together. And I'm going to ask you the question, what is that? Again, like the Cajun says, for you deep theoreticians, think on that a while. That'll stir your head bone. What I have just said, you know, coming down from the humor a bit, is that truth depends on topology. When you are so sure in your assessment of things being true or false, you had better be careful to specify your topology. Because a thing can be true, a statement can be absolutely true in one topology, and it can be absolutely false in another topology. So you must specify your topology, the topology being simply the conditions and the mechanisms of perception, that's all. Next slide, please. Now we're going to show you how to use that, because we have to use that law to generate a solution to the problem of mind. We're going to do that. It's just like that cube, that thing. If I collect every single bit of that thing together, I reach the boundary, and at that point it turns into its own opposite also. Ultimately, the modeling process is representing a thing in terms of its opposite. Geometry being nothing but the problem of representing things in terms of non-things, emptiness. Fullness in terms of emptiness. To show you how conclusive or how important this is, there are fundamental problems and foundations of mathematics which have resisted the solution of the best mathematical minds in the world for 50 years. One of them is as follows. The answer to the question, can a line be made of points? No present mathematician or logician can answer that question conclusively. We're going to answer it, because we now have the logic. To show you the problem, a point can be defined as that which has no length, no dimension, the absence of length. A line can be defined as something which shows and exhibits the presence of length, or just as simply as length. Well, then we have asked the question, can length be comprised of non-length? Can apples be made of oranges? And with three-law logic, the answer is no. And after 50 years of struggle, the mathematicians gave up, and they don't even try to anymore. They say, there is a class of entities called points. There is a class of entities called lines. Lines are made of points. Don't you ask a question, Dave. You shut up. You're going to write in your book what the teacher says. You're going to feed it back to me on examination. I'm going to give you a grade. You're going to go on and get your PhD, and then you're going to perpetuate the process. But don't you dare think. Does that sound familiar to any of you? We get a nice dogma that way. But you see, with the new logic, I can state it this way. There is one way to go about perception, and you just slice it, and that'll give you a point. And you can do as many of those as you wish. And if you start collecting all the slices that you wish, you can reach a point where your vision becomes binocular and you no longer can tell the difference between the little point that you think was sliced and the little tiny pieces between the points that you think were not sliced. When you make your vision binocular, then lines at that point are made of points. And the word in onto infinity means we violate the process of being able to pick each every one and give them a finite number. That's all infinite means. And so there's an infinite number of points on every line. I'm going to leave that. I'm not trying to get into advanced mathematics, but I wanted to show you that the logic I'm giving you is capable of resolving some of the most formidable problems in the world that have resisted some of the best minds in the world for many years. That's a very simple one, but we gave you the solution. The way to apply it is simply to collect all of a thing, and when you do, it is now its own opposite. Fine. Let's take the classical solution or problem of mind, and let's solve that dude with this new logic and this new methodology. The logical positivist would have us believe that you are a living robot, you have no mind, there is no such thing as a human, you're all robots. And they tried to destroy philosophy, and ladies and gentlemen, they almost succeeded. And physics and philosophy and science have never recovered from that violent effort in the first part of this century. And that's why the science we have in our universities today is so inhuman. That was a deliberate, sustained attempt to make it totally inhuman. And that almost succeeded. Let us now make it human. In this... that hit somebody. But let us take their own argument that whatever mind might be, it's of no importance and it's totally mutually exclusive from matter. Let us buy that nonsense. But keep in the back of our mind, this is a monocular dude. He don't know anything but the photon interaction logic. And so let us now collect the very thing he thinks he knows about, matter, and let's collect every single bit of it in the universe. We will not leave out a single bit, no matter how you represent it, virtual state, whatever, it doesn't matter. Let's get it all. When you collect every bit of it by the fourth law of logic, it immediately turns into its own opposite. The very thing you said was mutually exclusive from that is the only thing left, and that is mine. And I have just told you that a mind can be rigorously modeled as a physical universe. And it's as rigorous as anything else that exists in all of science and all of physics. So we have now captured the lost mind. You see, when you throw time away with your physical detections, you throw away the only dimension that mind normally occupies. Mind occupies time. At the same time you think physical things happening, the mental things are happening. The little thoughts are flicking and jumping like little fish in a pond. And in physics we declare, since we can't even measure time, we declare it to be objective. And we shake hands like gentlemen and say, don't you argue about that. We don't want to get into that cesspool. And we say here, fine, I believe you guys, I'm going to accept your argument. If you say time is objective, then you have just said mind is objective, and you better find out how to model it in an objective manner, or you are being guilty of non-scientific behavior. And so we have just taken the step they have not dared to take, and we have said it can be modeled as a physical universe, and in that universe you are God. You can create anything you wish, anytime you wish to pop a thought in there. Pow! I just got an elephant. How about that?
Amen, bro.
Next slide, please. We now are face-to-face. I worked for many years, and primarily work was in paranormal phenomena. This is not a paranormal talk, so I'm not talking about UFOs and all of that thing hardly at all. But my major work for many years has been to explain paranormal phenomena. And we do have in the book coming out explanations for the entire realm of paranormal phenomena. Everything from psychokinesis to UFOs to Loch Ness Monster to Sasquatch to nocturnal lights, everything. And the mechanisms by which they occur, they're all in there. But this now brings us to the classic representation of reality. Begrudgingly, they will admit mind exists as some fantasy or illusionary type of thing that has nothing to do physically. But you psychologists can explain, can work with it if you wish. The psychologists got embarrassed and they've been trying to get rid of the mind. Isn't that astounding? They should be studying it. And then we have what we call physical phenomena. And we don't represent, recognize presently in this logical positivist influenced physics and science, we have any influence of mind on matter, except quantum mechanics won't let it die. Quantum mechanics won't let them get away with it. They can't eliminate the observer. They can't eliminate the mind of the observer. And the advanced theoreticians know, finally, after all these years, that they can't get rid of mind. It's embedded in quantum mechanics. They don't know what to do about it, but there it is. They can't get rid of it. They sure tried. So So they represent it like the two banks of a river, and they claim there is no such thing as a bridge between those two banks. Now, I'm going to give you an example of that bridge. Suppose I were to hold up a pen. Now, that's a physical pen. How can I prove that? What is a physical pen? Nobody knows, but let's find out what it is. It has to be totally mental, right? From the fourth law of logic. If I can't convince you that's totally mental, I've just failed. Do you have it in your mind? I think you'll say yes if you're, you know, if you're not hallucinating, not on drugs or anything. Does someone over here have it in their mind? Yes. Do I have it in my mind? Yes. Could I come up and touch it and taste it and so forth? Yes. Could a little bug come in and land on it and show you he's got it in his buggy little mind? Yes. You can demonstrate conclusively that that is or can be in every single mind in this universe, from the paramecium to the germ to the bug to the human being. So it meets the criterion of being totally mind. Think of that as a little card, will you please? The card is in each mind. Every bug's got a card with that pen or something that represents that pen in his buggy little mind world. You and I all have cards. Now, our cards are very similar. They look like a pen. There is a mind-boggling, staggering number of cards condensed into that pen. So it seems very solid, very physical. Now, I get tired of it. I don't like my card. I want to get rid of the pen, so I pull my card out. Boy, that doesn't make hardly any effect at all. Because all you people and the bugs and the paramecium and the germs and everything else in the universe, and that includes on the far side, on all the planets in the universe, are sustaining that thing. You see, when you gather up all the consciousnesses, you've got God. Okay, God is sustaining it, if that turns you on. I happen to be religious. I don't apologize for being religious. I'm not dogmatic at all. Now, let us say another thing. Suppose I am hallucinating and I think I'm holding a pen in my hand. To me, it looks as real as that last one. I think I'm touching it, I think I'm tasting it, and I can tell no difference at all. How can I prove whether that's an hallucination or a real physical pen? I bring in some more competent observers. Now, if they can all touch it and taste it and all, it's going to be physical. But none of these others can touch it or taste it or anything else. I'm sitting there looking at it, and I feel it. And none of you can do it. And the bug flies right through it. Then that's a mental pen, a mental thought image that exists in one and only one mind. I made a little specific change there to mental phenomena. You notice, one and only one mind. Now I'm going to challenge you. This is a Gedanken experiment, so we can produce anything we wish to, and you must accept that as being what is occurring. And then we try to understand its nature. Suppose I now hold out this pen, and I'm not on drugs, I'm not sick, I'm not hallucinating, anything like that. And half of you can see it and touch it and taste it, and the other half can run your hands right through it. We bring in 10 bugs and five fly right through it, and the other five land on it and crawl around on it. Now what kind of phenomenon are you looking at? A most unusual one. A paranormal phenomenon, because we understand the normal being the one that I could see and nobody else could, or the one that we all could. But I put a bridge across the river, and that is the definition of paranormal phenomena. It can be shown to exist in one or more minds, but not all minds. In more than one minds, but not all. The definition of mental phenomena can be shown to exist in one and only one mind. Physical phenomena can be shown to exist in each and every mind. It's just when you get tired of the process, you quit demonstrating. And so the present science and the present psychology and the present philosophy and all that other nonsense we have, because they use three-law logic, they do not even admit or entertain the fourth, this new kind of phenomenon that I demonstrated for you by Gedanken experiment. And yet we are confronted with a very wide array of phenomena where we've been calling it the mind moves or changes matter, interacts with it. What we've actually grabbed a hold of is a nonlinear animal that wasn't mutually exclusive. It's both of them embedded together like the Gedanken experiment I gave you. And that's what psychotronics is all about. Learning where the nonlinear beasties are, the critters are that creep and crawl in the night and don't fit the normal definition, and then using them. Because you can use them to heal, you can use them to do bug control, You can use them to do psychic healing. You can produce psychic phenomena, etc., etc. You can move mind or matter with the mind and so forth, bend and break metal, all of these good things. You're guilty of psychokinesis all the time. You move a few electrons in your brain when you wish to, change the signals a bit, and then a big old servo amplifier takes over, and so I can wiggle my fingers. But the original input is not explainable by present science at all, the intent. What I call inception. I prefer a more technical term. After you get the input signal, the rest of it is mechanical, no problem. But the little input signals you're generating are sheer magic, according to our present imperfect science. Because they come across the barrier, they come across the bridge, they use the bridge. But just as the mind, you see, used electricity, used FM, and all of these good things long before we knew anything about it, used this other stuff too. The mind is radionic, the mind is psychotronic, it's also a virtual state device. I'll get to that later. Next slide, please. What I have told you is that scientific method as it is presently practiced today is flawed, seriously flawed. And I told you in a very rigorous and exact fashion, and it is proven correct by quantum mechanics. What I'm telling you is not mystical, it is not hypothetical at all. Every detection destroys time, partial respect to teeth, the mysterious collapse of the way you function. A wave must keep waving to exist. It exists in time, you see. It's not just a spatial critter, it exists in time. And if you throw away time, collapse time, destroy time, you stop that wave, bang, you freeze it. And that, I have just told you, how the mysterious collapse of the wave function in quantum mechanics occurs. That's something our guys don't know either. They simply pull it out of the thin air like a rabbit out of a hat. But when you lose time, that's what kills the wave function, and therefore you've got a spatial entity left. But we lose mind in that process because mind occupied time. So where would I go to look for mind? I'd probe around on your body, right? Oh, hell no. Where I would go to look for mind would be in the photons. In the photons. In the light. When you're doing all your color therapy and all your healing and aura looking and all, you are looking at subtler levels of mind. I'm going to show you what those levels are in terms of physics. Rigorous physics. They really exist. For real. And that's what you're actually dealing with. But we lose that time because we kill it with every single detection our instruments make, every measurement we make in the laboratory, and with every detection my senses make, I do the same thing. And so I have become enamored of this total delusion that I am a robot, because that's all I'm capable of detecting with my physical senses. But if I get non-physical with my sensing apparatus and I use the more subtle centers of the human being, then I recover the thing I lost by killing time. Everything we're talking about can also be represented as the structure of time. Time itself is consciousness. There is no distinction between the two. If you didn't hear anything else, hear that. A quantum change exists in an absolute frozen, chopped manner. Nothing is changing. Bang. And the next one is bang, and there's an instantaneous jump between the two. There's nothing in there about any continuity at all. The continuity is your mind. The thing you call time is your mind, is your consciousness. Next slide, please. I showed the coupling coefficient on that last slide as being 1 over C cubed. Later on, I'll show you how I got that. The mind effect on the physical world is normally 1 over C cubed. That's a very small number. In other words, if I take a picture of you and I wave that photograph like this, ever how much force, let us say I'm putting on 2 grams of force, or 1 gram of force, to be simple, then 1 over C cubed times that number is the amount of force I actually put on you where you are. Now do you understand how Hieronymus effect works if you amplify that? This is just a picture to show you another way to get your mind a hold of some of what I'm talking about. If you look at your TV screen, for example, and you forget about the fact that your scope keeps glowing after it's hit by an electron, forget that for a moment, At any one instant of time, there would be no picture on that screen at all. The only thing that exists on there is one little dot that's being hit by an electron, that's all. And we sweep that beam across so fast, and our consciousness, the screen retains it, and our consciousness retains so many jillions of those hits or misses, that what emerges is the picture of an apple. Now, I'm going to ask you the question with that analogy, that Gedanken experiment. Does the apple exist as a picture on that TV screen? I've eliminated now the retention on the screen, the fact that it can retain and keep glowing after it's hit. We're going to leave that out. It's a peculiar screen. No, it does not. But if your mind remembers all of that and retains it, where does the apple exist? In your mind. Every physical object exists as mind and mind only. I rest my case on that. Next slide, please. Can we have it down just a bit there? Okay. I'm not going to dwell too much on the deeper physics, but I'm going to point out to you that the total violation of relativity must occur at the absolute end of everything. Everything must be paradoxical at the end. It must meet the fourth law when you get all of it. If you get the total content of anything in relativity, what you wind up with is the frame itself. And the frame itself does violate relativity. For example, you assume that all of those points at separated spatial distances are in fact existing simultaneously, and that is totally non-detectable. That is not possible. Because relativity tells you that length divided by c is time. Time multiplied by c is length. So anything that has a length between two points has a time between those two points also. It is not possible for them to exist simultaneously. Einstein did that with his showed that with his original work. And so the idea of a frame is where it's hidden in relativity. It violates all relativity. Any theory must be shown to violate itself when you get it at the extreme boundary. The boundary is the opposite, you see. So it must become paradoxical there. Space-time. You can't observe it. You tear away time every time you observe. So you only observe spatial. You lose part of it. Time is a non-observable. So the only way we can represent reality is by tying together the observable and the non-observable. Tying together what the logical positive is called physical matter, and the thing they think it's mutually exclusive from, mind. The only way you can represent reality anyway is by matter times mind. That's the dimensions of it. L cubed times T. L cubed times mind. Time is mind. And it's all been fitted to one observer at a time. If you believe as stupid a thing as that we're all sitting in this room at the same time, you just blew the heck out of relativity. That was the consideration of that was done in 1956, Princeton University by Everett. When you consider the fact that we do exist simultaneously, if you believe that, as stupid a thing as that, if you accept that, then I assure you the physics that's taught in your local university is totally limited. Because the physics that emerges is so horrible, so bizarre, so terrible, that only about 8 or 10 American physicists have ever had the guts and the audacity to tackle it and immerse themselves in that terrible stuff. It is mind-wrenching, because everything that could be is all at once. Well, if you really believe in an unlimited creator, isn't that right? Could I think of anything that wasn't thought of already? Every possibility is concrete and real in its own physical universe, and they're all orthogonal to each other. There's an infinite number of dimensions. God didn't learn just to count to four. He kept right on counting. All at once, bang. So, if you believe in that, then the monocular science we presently have falls on its face. And by the way, all of the experiments of science are totally consistent with this crazy new physics. I'm talking about the Everett Wheeler-Graham theory of many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. I won't go into that, but I just wanted to point out to you, when you say a thing is in the mind or a thing is possible but it's not concretely real, you don't know what you said. If the darn thing is possible, there is a space where it is real. And what I have said about your mental thought being as concrete and as physical as this desk is rigorous. And rigorously true if you believe we are all sitting in this room. If you do not believe the statement that what is in your mind is concretely real, then you must accept the fact that all you people are imaginary, and I'm the only cat standing here. Next slide, please. This, of course, is the old philosophical problem of, if you're dreaming, what's the dream? The dreamer or the dream? Okay, I'm going to pass rapidly through that. But anyway, if an electron is taken as the point of observation, Einstein's postulate says that any free photon in the universe moving at speed c with respect to that dude. We're going to blow relativity apart right now. You tiptoe over and you stand on that photon, you look back at that electron is going at the speed c with respect to you. Now, if that bites your craw and you can't swallow that one, you object to that, then you have said that you can have the speed c in one direction but not in the other, and that sets up a preferred frame that destroys relativity. You had it. On the other hand, if you believe it, because you can't you can't get out of it, if you believe this paradox, then what you've said is mass can travel at the speed c, and all this other nonsense is nonsense. I've told you already the solution. Velocity is the measure of rotation. C is the rotation at right angles. The thing lost one dimension. So when mass moves at the speed C, it is no longer a three-dimensional critter. It's only a two-dimensional wavefront, so it has no mass. Mass has to be three-dimensional. That's the definition. Next slide, please. Finally, with all of that, if I hadn't given you all of this mess, you wouldn't know what I had on this slide. I build a very simplified model. Now, you can make it much more complex than this, but this is one you can get your head bone a hold of, like the Cajun said. Imagine, if you will, a wheel with an axle and a number of spokes around the wheel. Only there's an infinite number of spokes as you go around. The wheel sort of goes on forever in a crazy way. And the spokes are 90 degrees apart, but there's a crazy space you're operating in, so you can have as many 90-degree turns away without coming back as you wish. You're not operating in a limited three-dimensional space. And this wheel model of reality, by the way, will allow us to get all the paranormal phenomena, get the psychotronic phenomena, and explain everything else. I've already dealt with you. Each line, by the way, in the spoke, each spoke is a universe, the physical spatial thing you see. The axle is time. And time doesn't exist anyway. That's you consciousness, and all of our consciousness is right there making that. So let's focus in on the spatial aspects. A right angle turn away from the first spoke is the world we see as we're sitting here statically in this universe, the lab frame, so to speak. If I make a right angle turn away from that thing, it's a perfectly ordinary frame over there where it's at, perfectly ordinary world, universe, but its intersection with this one is only in two dimensions, so it's the electromagnetic field. I have just told you that an electromagnetic field is a very marvelous thing. It's full of critters. Quantum particle theory, by the way, now agrees with me, because anything is continually changing into and surrounded by and composed of a cluster of jillions and jillions and infinite numbers of virtual particles, little magic pieces of nothing, but they're virtual electron, virtual photon, virtual everything in there, like that, going crazy. Everything is made of that, whether you're talking a photon or whether you're talking an electron or whatever, made like that. It's a mix master operation going on like mad inside there of little pieces of nothing, like a whole world full of nothing, you see. Now, if you make a turn away from that, again, in a departing direction, when you get another right angle turn, you lose one more dimension. Your intersection back in the real world, so to speak, where we normally operate in, is now only one dimensional, transverse. You still got your velocity direction going, whatever the thing, if you're moving. But it now moves, if it could move freely, at the speed c squared. It cannot move freely, because its interaction with the intermediate electromagnetic field is just like photon interaction with an ordinary hunk of mass. And so what you find is this thing, this new critter, which I call a bare neutrino. It's an ordinary neutrino divided by c over 2. And a neutrino is just a flux of these. A neutrino is half of a photon. You got a neutrino in the positive half and a neutrino in the negative half. Or I got that vice versa. But this bare neutrino only has a one-dimensional intersection in this universe, but it's fluctuating and circulating in the carrier, which is electromagnetic field. So if you tried to measure a neutrino, all you can do is measure the neutrino you pulled out of the electromagnetic field. On rare occasions, you can get one to hop out. And you'll think it moved at the speed c, because that's the carrier velocity. It does not at all. It moves at the speed c squared. Now if we make one more turn, by the way, I'm going to say something right here for the theorists. Those of you who are not, just hang on a moment. For you theorists, you write down something and you go home and you think about that for a while. If you've lost one of those other dimensions in the electromagnetic wave, that constitutes what we've been crazily calling a longitudinal photon. If you want to understand what I'm talking about, you go study longitudinal electromagnetic wave for the next 3 years. Try it. Okay. If we make one more turn, we lose the last dimensional intersection we had in this space that we operate in. That thing is still a perfectly ordinary physical particle over in its world, but it's three turns away, three flips away, and its intersection here spatially is zero. If it could move freely, it would move at the speed c cubed, but it can't, because all the thing it can do is circulate in a bare neutrino, which circulates in turn in a photon. And so, that, by the way, is a mind, thought form. We believe, the logical positivist, that mind and matter are totally mutually exclusive, and that is the way they get mutually exclusive. That's what I've created for you. If that now, instead of being a particle, is a rostrum like this one, and the whole rostrum is turned three dimensions away from this space in the correct manner, this rostrum will be as physical in its own realm as could be, but to us it will not exist at all. At all. 1 over c cubed of its forces and interactions going on it is transmitted back into this frame, and that's in a virtual state. You will never measure it with your instruments unless you cohere them. And so a mind does turn out, a mind thought form does turn out to be as real and physical as anything ordinary physical in its own realm. And the mind itself turns out to be the entire universe over there into which all that's connected. Let's chase down life. Next slide, please. First, I'm going to tie together something that has not appeared in the literature anywhere, and it allows the direct engineering of hyperspace and the direct engineering of nested levels of virtual state. So you theorists, perk up. I'm going to tell you how to do the trick, how to do the magic show. If you look and you look at rotation, and then you put in quantum mechanics, you realize that any detector process has a fundamental minimum length at which it can produce from quantum fission of the action. And when your rotation is almost 90 degrees, but not quite, but where its projection gets to that fundamental limiting length of detection, it passes into the virtual state. Yeah, baby, you don't have to quite get to the speed of light to flip out of this world and become photonic instead of physical, massive. And therefore, a photon can be born. If it had to achieve infinite momentum and infinite force and all, it could never get a photon born in the first place. But it just gets good enough for government work. This is a tunneling process. But if it turns then, you can regard that as an instantaneous jump. And the next turn is turning inside that small length. And there's another smaller length for it, quantum action over where it's at. And so you see your virtual state has nested levels, and particle physics now substantiates that. But nobody has thought of this concept. Higher dimensional spaces and nested levels of virtual state are one and the same thing. So where's your mind in the third level in the virtual state? Now do you understand where mind is and how to go after it? Now I'm going to tell you something else, and I'm going to pass. Every time you modulate a photon, you change it by one dimension. If you modulate the modulation, you add the next hyperspace projection, the next level of virtual state component. If you modulate that, you add the next one, and so forth. When you've done that two levels, you're already one level removed from this world. When you modulate the modulations and you nest them that way, you are now doing direct mind engineering. I'm going to show you, the Soviets have known this for years. I'm going to show you how they're using it in the woodpecker signal later on. And I'm going to show you how the Priori machine uses that to cure cancer and has been doing that in leukemia for 15 years. Next slide, please. here is one simple way to represent the virtual state levels. You see your mass level, and then you're going down to the quantum level. You get below the quantum, you pass into the virtual state. When you chop the second order quantum, you get into the second level, and so forth. And there are infinite number of levels. We know that from quantum physics. Each one of those represents a higher dimensional space dimension also. The two are synonymous. It also is as simple a thing as modulating correctly, the crazy kind of modulation, on electromagnetic waves. I have told you a mechanism which will allow you to do direct engineering of the virtual state, and which will allow you to do direct engineering in hyperspace, higher dimensional space, and build devices which work in those new spaces. Next slide, please. This is just to show you the Feynman diagram, type 1. If an electron moves from point A to B on the way, no matter how short a movement that is, an infinite number of things happen to it along the way. It changes into photons, then they break into particles and all kind of junk, and they all get back together, and that's the Nix-Master process. An infinite number of things are happening. Next slide, please. And this one shows you something that they left out of your textbook. What is a photon? It's one single cycle of an electromagnetic wave, the positive time wiggle and the negative time wiggle. If you stop both of those, you have stopped the wave. You now have a particle. That's photon. Photon only occurs when you stop the wave. Otherwise, it just makes another wave. But if you stop it, you get a whole wave, so you get the quantum process. But the textbooks forgot to tell you, because they didn't know, that a photon is one single cycle of an electromagnetic wave. Now you know. Next slide, please. And it's time which is waving. You can see a little bit of this if you show an magnetic field in front of a TV screen, because instead of the little particles that we normally show magnetic field with being still and showing a nice symmetrical pattern, you're sweeping the sampling particles now, and they will show an unsymmetrical pattern. You're showing some of the second hyperfield component in magnetic field. I'm letting you look at neutrinos, is what you're looking at on this slide. The neutrinic composition, the neutrinic flux that's circulating in electromagnetic field. Next slide, please. Don't worry about space and time. There's a new twister theory coming out of Pembroke and his cohorts and colleagues in England that is steadily gobbling up all of physics. It has now successfully gobbled up all of relativity theory. There's nothing in relativity that Pembroke and his associates cannot explain by this new, more fundamental theory. And it's on its way now to doing the same thing for quantum mechanics. So yes, there is a single comprehensive theory beginning to emerge. It's just like relativity when it got started. It's so hairy and complex, only a few guys understand it, but it is being slowly successful. Next slide, please. Now, this one is near and dear to my heart because of my long struggle mentally to try to comprehend the great marvel that T. Henry Morey built in Salt Lake City, Utah, many years ago. The great dream of humanity has been to get free energy, and Morey did it in the 20s and 30s. The greatest scientific accomplishment that has ever been done was done in an obscure laboratory in Salt Lake City in the 20s and 30s by T. Henry Morey. Make no bones about it, it was real and it existed, and as you understand from your program, his son, John Morey, is here with us at this convention. We're privileged to have him here, and he is going to give you a full presentation on his father's formidable work. He reasoned that the very emptiness of space itself was full of unlimited energy, and a person could tap it if he worked right. And he succeeded in tapping it and getting it out. He produced, by 1939, 50 kilowatts of power from a 55-pound box. Could have got a lot more out of it because it was still progressing. An unlimited, free, clean means of power which would solve all the power needs of the world. He was never able to convince anybody of what he had done. But he built in the 20s and 30s a more advanced transistor than anyone in this country has built to date. But slowly the theory has come around to where we now know some of the things he did were correct. The fact that the energy is there in vacuum is correct. Take a piece of empty space as big as the tip of my finger, about 1 cubic centimeter. There is enough empty energy in there, incoherent energy. If you could cohere it and condense it, you could get entire solar systems out of it. About 10 to the 100th grams, give or take a few digits up there in the exponent, depending on how you make the calculation. Fantastic amounts of energy permeating empty space. Remember the fourth law of logic. That which is nothing must turn into everything if you pursue it. And space obeys that law. It is full and filled. It is energy and only energy, incoherent, and also in the virtual state. But he did cohere that. We know that it exists now. The Lamb shift proves it. Every hydrogen atom has done this since the beginning of time. And he succeeded in tapping it. He took germanium and some other ingredients, one being a radioactive element, and ground them up as fine as he could, and he made a pellet pressed of that. Now, the grains were randomly oriented. Boy, you try to get a transistor as a crystal, right? You try to make it linearly oriented, not random. Because the second law of thermodynamics says randomness is bad, right? The fourth law of logic would come back in and say that second law is wrong if you press it far enough. And you may think I'm a fool for challenging the second law of thermodynamics. Well, I'm playing it safe. I got you sandbagged. Because it's already been successfully challenged and refuted. In 1977, Prigogine was given the Nobel Prize for beating that thing all around the head and ears. It only applies primarily to a linear system. If you have a highly disordered system, far from thermal equilibrium, large-scale order will emerge, totally in contradistinction to the second law of linear thermodynamics. And the more degrees of freedom, the more that thing can flip-flop and vary, if it's unlimited particularly, those forms will be stable. And it is that process by means of which, from the incoherent, terrible chaos of empty vacuum, the ordered physical classical world emerges in the first place. By the Prigogine effect. And T. Henry Moray built a Prigogine effect transistor in the 20s and 30s, 30-something years before the so-called discovery of the transistor. We have yet to build a Prigogine transistor in this country otherwise. And so, with that kind of a collector system, if you stick a random enough dipstick into the random energy of vacuum, randomness will cohere to randomness. You theoreticians listen, write down a series of random numbers. Write it again. Is the second series random? But the second series has 100% correlation to the first series. The only way you can cohere randomness is with other randomness. If you never heard anything else, write that down. The Prigogine effect, the other kind of thermodynamics, different from the ones you've been studying in your textbooks. And these devices will work if you're clever enough. Now, the radioactive element, if it's unbalanced in the nucleus, that's a hyperspace component. The radioactive nucleus of every radioactive isotope has hands hanging out in hyperspace. T. Henry Moray put a hyperspace ingredient with a random Prigogine collection, he made a more advanced transistor than has yet been built in this country. And it worked, and it was for real, and it existed, and John Moray is going to tell you about it. The greatest scientific invention of all time was ignored. The Soviets had an agent in that lab in 39. We won't go into all of that mess. That's where they got the original amplifier, was T. Henry Moray's work. That's where they first glommed on the fact you could do this. Moray proved it, not the Russians. The theory they've been using is the Ives theory. Write that name down, check it out. I won't go into that either. Next slide, please. Here is a representation of that Prigogine coherence. If you cohere a signal in random noise, and then you do it again, and you've got one part of it is coherent, I show the same signal existing in that noise, and you add them up just like you have MTI with a radar, the coherent signals will add linearly. 1 plus 1 is 2, plus 1 is 3, and so forth. The noise will only add partially, fractionally. And so you will increase the signal to noise ratio. The coherent signal will grow right up out of the noise and stabilize. That's the way every MTI on a radar works, like that, so to speak. I'm using not phase MTI, I'm using amplitude MTI. And that's the way you can cohere the zero point emptiness of vacuum, and that's the way Moray did it with a proper Prigogine detector. And that's the way your human nervous system does it with all the bursts of random electrons that exist in discharges across the synapses. For goodness sakes, if nature simply needed to take a signal from point A to point B in your body, and that was all she wanted to do, she'd have built the direct wire. But you're not built that way at all. You have avalanche discharges in your brain. Tremendous spark discharges, very low voltage, very low currents, but tremendous avalanche discharges. And on each of that disordered, whichever way that electron is oriented in a field, represents a random disorder. That's a Prigogine transistor detection effect. And that's what couples you to your mind world, because in this world beyond here, there are infinite number of those mind worlds out there. And the only way to cohere to yours is to go into randomness with your own set of firing patterns that'll cohere to your mind. Now let's wipe you out. Well, break up the tuner. You disconnect from your mind world because you can't cohere to the correct pattern in the third level of virtual state. That's the third hyperframe out there. You can't grab the right world. Your mind didn't go anywhere. So where the devil do you exist when you die? In your own mind world. What is there? Whatever you put there. Can I get you back? You better believe it. All I got to do is have your pattern, and we can put you back. Your body has got your tuning pattern in it genetically, in the genes, in the chromosomes. So all I really got to do is, if I can rub your heart or whatever and restore the functioning of the tuner, shock it back into effect, into its tuning oscillation correctly, back you come, and it's the same you and the same mind world most of the time. There are incidents where people have been shocked back, a few, very rare, but it does occur, and it's connected to a different mind world. And what I'm telling you is that Thomas Edison was not stupid when he was trying to build a device to communicate with the dead, because the dead are not dead, they're still alive. And if you have something with that person's tuning pattern, a photograph is good enough. I am telling you, it is at least at this point theoretically possible to develop a mechanism to tune in that mind world and communicate directly with that individual. Of such things will psychotronics of the next few years be composed. You want to live forever? You can't die. You just need a way to communicate. Anybody really is hung up on this living and dying business, you know, and really wants to live forever, psychotronically, about $10 million will buy you the development that will allow you to do just that. And we're going to see that if we have 10 years left of the human species. Give me one more slide here, and then we're going to break for lunch, and I'll finish shortly after lunch. I wanted to show you a picture. I'm not trying to steal John's thunder, but because I have put so much work of my own in trying to understand that device, over the years, I have gained the greatest admiration for what was actually done in Salt Lake City, Utah. Believe me, it was for real. The device existed. It was beaten apart and torn up by a person there who I believe was a Soviet agent. It was for real. It can be rebuilt again. And one of the great hopes of my life is that somebody has the vision to understand that the theory that I'm talking about here today is what T. Henry Moray was using. He wasn't using these words, but he was thinking in terms of an energy concept that had to do with these things. And this is the way today we would have to express it. And wouldn't it be nice if somebody would drop about $5 million on John Moray, rebuild that device, and let's get rid of this energy crisis forever. And with that, let's break and go to lunch. Good evening again, or good afternoon, after our lunch period. I'll try to wind this up in about 30 to 45 minutes and try to get through the rest of the material. I did want to now go into some of the devices
and show you, give you a glimpse of the direct applications of some of these things and some of their potential, and in two fields, one in physical devices and another in the field of sorting out and straightening out many of the concepts of reality that we've all beat one another over the heads with dogmatic systems from time to time. Let's see if we can't cut through some of the dogma and get at a science of reality rather than dogmatic approaches. This slide right here shows a whole host or group of psychotronic generators built by the Czechoslovakian Robert Pavlita, who has been building them for 30 years. These are the simple ones he's been able to show publicly. My main intention is to call your attention to the iron ring and towards the left foreground. That ring has the unique distinction that if you place a fly in there, it will kill him. And it is not magnetic and it is not electrical, but it is jolly well psychotronic, which just means virtual state. Anytime you hear the term psychotronics now and you're thinking in terms of engineering, please replace it with the term virtual state engineering. And when you hear the term mind, please realize that the mind is a virtual universe and the functioning mind is a virtual state machine. If you will think of it that way, you will see that these terms do and are directly related. The next slide, please. Psychotronics is a Czech term. The Soviets used the term for a long time, psychoenergetics. They now use just the term energetics. Now, let me define the term, since I don't believe we've done that yet in the whole convention. Psycho means mind or mind energy. Tronics means, you know, matter or devices. And so when we use the term psychotronics, we are really talking about the interaction and the union of mind and matter. In this slide, I won't have time to dwell on it too much, but it's what I call my Eureka slide. This is the realization that modulations, particularly nested modulations on electromagnetic signals, have hyperspace components, which also means they have components down into the lower levels of virtual state. And so the implications of this are that you now can build a direct theory and build devices to operate in higher dimensional space and in the lower levels of virtual state. We can operate directly into and onto the mind itself, for example, and we can operate directly into and through hyperspace around this space-time world. And so we can get away from limitations like friction, limitations like conservation of energy and so forth. Virtual state interactions always violate conservation of energy. Anyway, the slide just shows that all those are really the same thing, and what we have to do, we have to put additional differentials on Maxwell's equations. Now, for you technical guys, write in your notebooks these statements here. Once the Lorentz condition is applied to electromagnetic theory, you have just thrown out all the virtual state stuff and all of the stuff that I've been talking about. Before you apply a gauge theory, you must deal with the essence in the beginning of electromagnetic theory, or you will not obtain what I'm talking about. So if you have fallen in love with Maxwell's equations, which only exist after those conditions have been applied, you have thrown away everything I'm saying. What I am telling you constitutes modifications to Maxwell's equations, certain of those modifications already being known in the literature but not recognized as such. Next slide, please. This is what a human being or a living form is. It's a mind connected to a tuner, a body. And what we have here is a large number of quantum changes must occur in the physical body before the virtual state projections three worlds away into that mind world build up enough through the virtual state over there to make one quantum change. And then a large number of quantum changes in the mind world must then occur before the virtual projection back at the third level in the real physical world builds up enough to get a real observable quantum change. Now, the total time that it takes to do all of that, meanwhile, in the real physical world, you have all these other quantum changes which just happen to blap from some other mind world occurring. And so you have a very limited control in the physical world. You can get one quantum change in every once in a great while, and that's a very large number for the great while. So you have a very small effect, but you do have a pure psychokinetic effect. The time interval, or if you will, the ratio of the number of times you can get one in to the number of times the change occurs at random from other mind worlds, gives you the size of the physical universe that you can experience with your closed loop feedback system. Now, the channel going out and coming back for a closed feedback loop is consciousness. That's what gives you time in the first place. That is your consciousness loop. And what we call life is the attachment of such a channel, a preferred channel to one mind world from one physical body tuner. And that's what a living system is. I have now defined for you rigorously and biologically a living biological system. And a dead one, of course, is just clipping that consciousness loop. For example, if we come in there and jam that with noise, which you can do, you will clip the consciousness loop. And when you do that, you kill the system by simply separating the mind directly with like a little snip of scissors. And that is the so-called death ray that you've heard about several times probably. Certain people have played around with that. It is nothing to play around with. One of the reasons that bug control and insect control of radionics was stopped, or sort of stopped of its own volition in the United States, even after 10 years successful testing, is the fact that if you have zeroed in on that mechanism, it's very little different, you see, to change the dials a little and zero in on the human conscious loops. And then you are doing in your fellow humans in mass, and that isn't too pleasant at all. Next slide, please. Nor is that our intent here to go into the such uses of this particular science. Slide here shows that you get one jump to your mind world from many quantum jumps here. For many quantum jumps in your mind world, you finally get one back here, and that is your consciousness loop after much time delay. The total time delay will give you or control the size of the physical universe you are able to experience with your detection and detection mechanisms. So yes, the physical universe does have a physical size. It is closed, and the Einstein spherical model of the universe is in fact real. And when they get through with enough measurements, right now they're getting data that shows it's closed and data that shows it's open, and there's the good old fourth law again. You can get either one depending on how you stick your dipstick into the water, so to speak. But ultimately they will find it is closed by the consciousness, not by the physical dipstick. Next slide, please. And this shows that every time you get one of your intentional quantum changes in, you change the past. You change the causal path that you were proceeding along, just like turning a boat in the water. And I'm happy to say that at least part of physics now agrees with that. The fact that the past can be changed before the next observation occurs has been conclusively, I feel, established by John Wheeler, the great physicist John Wheeler, in the delayed choice two-slit experimental analysis that he's done. That's printed in the hardcore literature. So yes, as strange a thing as the fact that the past can be changed, even after all the so-called interactions have occurred, it can happen as long as you hadn't made the next observation. It does happen. Next slide, please. This slide gives us another look at a living system and a dead system. If we clip the consciousness loop, or if we lose the attuning ability, it's just like tuning your radio set. If your tuner breaks down to where you can't tune the channel accurately, you get all this noise in and you lose the signal. And that constitutes death. That might happen, for example, if your heart stops beating and the processes in the body begin to broaden the tuning and you can't tune properly anymore. Your brain is suffering and everything. Your tuner goes. Then the surgeon may take emergency measures and go back in and work on your tuner and vigorously work on it and succeed in reestablishing the operation of the tuning device, retune the TV set to the proper channel, so to speak. In that case, you simply get your own mind world back and there you are again. If we built a special tuner, which was not necessarily that physical body, could be a machine or a device, we could at least theoretically put the dead on the TV set. I believe we could do that for about $10 million. I'm quite serious. I don't think it's that complicated a technical problem. It's mostly a development problem from this point on. The theory is there. Next slide, please. This one I just wanted to show in a little different detail. Again, you can have living and dead systems and you can retune to them. If this is true, it means that the forms that have been tuned, you should be able to reinstitute the tuning. And in fact, from the Miller-Fox experiments, which I do not have slides for in my lecture here today, in the laboratory we have discovered that if you reproduce the original form in the flask in the laboratory of the acids in the soup, so to speak, the primeval broth that existed in the ocean, the ammonia in the atmosphere, and you fire lightning bolts into it, you fire electrical discharges, you will get, in fact, protonoids kindled. If you do it in the presence of heat and temperature, you will get living microspheres which live and reproduce themselves. That has been done in the laboratory. Now, if you want to define that properly, you will say that life has been formed. If it's tuned to a little mind world, no matter how elementary, it is life. And so, yes, life is formed. The interesting thing is, it turns out there isn't anything dead. Everything physical is a glip. Every quantum change in a physical system is a glip or a blip in somebody's mind world. So all the physical matter is totally alive. Will you listen to me a moment? It is non-preferentially alive. It just as soon move in this direction as that direction because it's so much randomness. What we call a living system has developed simply a tiny bit of preference in that randomness. That is all. And so, yes, the entire universe is totally alive. There is absolutely nothing dead. And the logical positivist has been living inside a living system all this time and didn't even know it. The matter that he seeks and worships so much is itself totally mind and totally alive. Next slide, please. This just shows you that everything is charged. Even a neutron is continually turning back and forth into a proton in the nucleus by batting the little positive charge back and forth. And as I told you, when little charges go back and forth, they do all kinds of crazy blips, an infinite number of things along the way. Oh, well, how nice. If you could reach down into the nucleus of an atom, for example, when the proton and the neutron are going bananas by trading the positive charge around there, each is turning into the other and so forth, if you could kill the positive charge along the way when it had just left a proton and taken away the proton's positive charge, that element would be transmuted one element down the scale, on an isomer scale. It would still have the same number of nucleons, total particles, but one less charge in the nucleus. Living systems can do that. If you caught the thing when the little particle happened to break in the right place inside a neutron, break temporarily into a negative and a positive charge, a proton with a little negative charge attached temporarily, if you were to kill that negative charge in there, you would wind up with an extra proton, a loss of one neutron and the gain of one proton, and you would transmute that element up the isomer scale by one element. Now let's take a look at that. Next slide. In fact, that has been shown conclusively to happen in living systems. Specifically, I'm calling attention to chickens. You can feed chickens a rich potassium diet, terribly deficient in calcium, and the doggone chickens will stay fat, dumb, and happy. And if you kill them and measure carefully, you will find that they have the normal amount of calcium and they've had a decrease in the potassium. And oats and wheat and barley and a few other things can do that. Kervran, the Frenchman, did this, and of course nobody believed him at all, and yahooed him and ridiculed him and so forth, as they always do, until the Japanese verified his experiments themselves, and in 1977, they nominated him for a Nobel Prize. He did not get it. That was the year of Prigogine. But he was a Nobel nominee in 1977 for that work. The average biologist at your local university hasn't even heard of it. It is true, nonetheless. The human system, psychotronically, hyperspatially, can reach around space-time and come into the nucleus of the atom itself direct with mind energy kindling into neutrino, bare neutrinos, kindling further into virtual photons. At that point, it can kill that charge. And it can do direct transmutation of elements. And you don't have to bang things together and get all these violent gamma rays and all that. Nothing like that occurs. You just hop up the chain of elements gently. Now, what happens to the charge you kill? It turns into a neutrino, zips off out through the universe, doesn't bother anything. Next slide, please. So transmutation of an element has been conclusively established, and a man was nominated for the Nobel Prize for that. This is the Hieronymus device. If you simply visualize that when a thing is four-dimensional, it's not split into the third dimensional yet, and time separated from it, it is a piece of nothingness. It is not detected or detectable at that point. As long as it's handled in that thing, it means that in the input to an electrical machine, we can have three kinds of things. We can have waves, which are two-dimensional in this space, and they occupy time. They have a third dimension, which is time. We can have particles, which are three-dimensional spatial critters. And we can have four-dimensional things, which are particle times time, mass times time. They are pieces of nothing, very magic pieces. If you then have a linear separator up front so that the waves die, the things that are exclusively waves, and the things that are exclusively particles die, you leave the four-dimensional critters, the pieces of action. They're made of action directly. And it turns out that it's like everything has one hand, a wave hand, a particle hand, only these have two hands. And they come along to the refractory prism side here and they say, oh, you want me to act with my left hand as a wave. So they walk through with the left hand. Then they come to the next stage, which says, oh, no, you can't act like a wave. You've got to act like a particle. And so it's okay, I'll just go through with my right hand. They go through and they get amplified and all that other nonsense, and they come out and they circulate in coils, and they generate their own special analogs of ordinary fields with one additional result. The field is multiplied and attached to time. It has an extra dimension. So it's a piece of nothing. It's a swirl in nothingness. But the human system has and uses such swirls in nothingness, and so the human biological system can detect that. We will be able to build instruments to do that same detection and are proceeding in that fashion at the present point with some success, and I will not answer any questions further than that on what we're doing. Nonetheless, that's the way the Hieronymus machine works. It simply separates the ordinary waves out, filters out the ordinary particles, lets the four-dimensional stuff go, and the only thing that's been used in the past, been found that could detect that, is a living system. So it could transmute four-dimensional analogs of anything you know about, waves, particles, whatever, any kind of living form, any kind of life form, but with a hyperspace component. And so if you put a witness in there with a three-dimensional pattern wiggling these four-dimensional stuff, you've got the four-dimensional pattern, which is attached to the object in the first place. And yep, they're right. The witness remains attached to the object of which it is a witness through hyperspace directly with zero length between them. If you can amplify that enough, you can do anything to the original object you wish merely by influencing or affecting the witness. Next slide, including kill a nuclear submarine called Thresher with it from its picture. I'm calling attention here to Dr. Popp's work in Germany, fantastic work where he has conclusively shown that a living system, the cells of the system, are holographically communicating with each other in the virtual state with virtual photons. There is a virtual photon field with which the body actually communicates. The body uses hyperspace virtual state engineering, psychotronics, to control itself healthfully in the first place. And Pop has measured it photon by photon. The normal photons emitted are simply the spillage from that field. And yes, indeed, ladies and gentlemen, the body does have auras. They are in the virtual state, and there are nested layers of them. There are multiple auras. They are real, and they are real little pieces of nothing, just like electric field is around a charged electron. They are just as real. They are a little bit more subtle. Next slide, please. That's hardcore physics work as published in some of the hardcore journals. The cell, then, is tied into, with this virtual EM field, to the entire body. And that's why the entire pattern of the individual is and has to be in each cell. It's a hologram. The part is the whole rather than belonging, simply being part of the whole. And so we are holographically made. The blueprint of the pattern that resonates in this control system is contained in each and every cell. And each cell is tuned in. And all that something like cancer is when one of the cells doesn't tune correctly, or a group of them don't tune correctly, and they mistune and they turn into something a little different. And then they don't have the controls impressed on them to grow to a certain point and stop because they're mistuned, maltuned, and they continue to grow under their own. Essentially, then, a cancer is its own living critter out of control of the human system. Next slide, please. The Soviets reported in the literature, and I use the reference here, the result of 5,000 experiments showing clearly that this indeed occurs, that virtual photons, including the exact frequency, which is in the near ultraviolet, that is the life form frequency. There is a flat number attached to the frequency at which life is communicated in the virtual state channels between the mind world and the physical body tuner. And that's in the near ultraviolet. And the Soviets measured it and reported it in these 5,000 experiments. They are military experiments, unfortunately, used for weaponry. And they found that you can transmit this way any type of disease pattern from one group of disease cells or any kind of death pattern into another group of cells. Now, you could just as easily amplify a healthful message and send over there. The best way would be to leave all the healthful channels alone and right around the health channels put in a heck of a lot of noise. In other words, razor blades, it'll cut anything out that don't fit the pattern. And if you radiated the human body with that kind of doubly modulated electromagnetic wave, what you would do is you would gently massage the living system. It would think it was in a very healthful massage. It wouldn't bother it a bit. But anything like a cancer that deviates from the healthful human control system in that virtual level pattern, that spectral pattern that it has, anything that deviates from that would simply get sliced to bloody ribbons. That is, its little mind world would be clipped from its physical body, that is, its cells, and it would die. And you can kill cancers 100% and leukemia and all that other stuff that way, and I'll show you it has been done. And that's exactly how it works. Next slide, please. Here, I'm going again into the fact to reiterate and emphasize that nested modulations on electromagnetic waves do operate directly in nested levels of virtual state and higher dimensional spaces. And so they are not bound necessarily by the ordinary laws of Lorentz condition applied electromagnetic theory. Next slide, please. In fact, I showed on that slide that if you got to the third flip over there, the third hyperworld, the third nested level, you are directly in the mind itself, the mind frame. And this is the nested modulation. We go from mass, we go to the electromagnetic carrier as one flip, we go the next flip to the first order modulation, has a weak neutrino effect, and if we nest the modulations, we at that point have a weak component hanging out inside mind itself. So if you really want to know the effects of electromagnetic signals, specifically long-term weak signals, on living biological systems, throw away everything that's been done in the literature. It isn't worth a damn. The real effect comes into account from the beats that create modulations in nonlinear, when they enter nonlinear systems, or in the modulations. We have to do a complete new approach to the study of the effects of these kinds of non-ionizing fields on biological systems. We have to look at the modulations. Next slide, please. This is the Priori machine. It's precisely the way it works. Nested modulations works like a charm. Built by the French government at a cost of $3 million. I am telling you, ladies and gentlemen, that if we could change the rigid barriers in our heads, in the last 15 years, almost no one in this country had to die of cancer or leukemia. The cure, the 100% almost cure, has been in existence for almost 15 years in France. The man who presented the results of the experiments done with this machine was Dr. Curier, the secretaire perpetuel of the French Academy of Sciences. It will withstand the most rigorous investigation. But it has split the French Academy because the academicians cannot understand how it works. With four-dimensional heads, you cannot understand six- and seven-dimensional functioning. Next slide, please. Anybody wants to build that cure for cancer, we're talking $5 million. I'm quite serious. I'm absolutely dead-level serious. The machine's in existence, been rigorously proven. We can cure cancer and leukemia almost 100%. We need $4 million. The machine's four stories high. We're not talking about a little device. The only thing you hit the human being with is rippling magnetic field. You don't burn him, you don't cut him, you don't hurt him one bit. And two shots or three shots and he's cured, period. Because all the cancers died. But the healthy cells didn't even get touched. That's exactly how it worked. Flanagan's neurophone, the neurophone, and I'm talking about the second version of it, forms clipped waves from the sine waves and then doubly differentiates them. When he does the double differentiation, you see, he moves into the third nested level. So he has a weak component from this thing directly into the mind stuff. And the different time modulations, that's mind stuff. And so the neurophone is for real. It will work, and it will put material directly into the brain and mind itself, completely around all the sensory input devices. Now, I want to use an adaptation of that machine. It has to be at least 11 independent channels. The channels have to be correct. And if so, we can do something magnificent I'll be showing you later on. Next slide. These are Soviet early experiments leading to the Lisitsyn paper. These are the biological radio experiments. And in the book here that I'm quoting, Kashinsky's work, the Russians stated that they had successfully succeeded with what they were calling electromagnetic means. They didn't explain it further than that, with implanting ideas and minds and stuff directly in a mind and brain directly. When it does that, it's processed by the individual as if he himself originated it. Does not know that it came from an external source. I'm telling you that in the open literature, the Russians frankly admit they have successfully done this. By 1962, they had done it. Next slide, please. Now, in the Soviet Union, there is a small center which contains a lot of computers and all, and it's a sort of a documentation center. It's a depository for all of the medical information in the Soviet Union. The man who runs that is named Lisitsyn, a very powerful individual. He did his original graduate work in very advanced nonlinear mathematical theory of brain waves. Lisitsyn wrote a paper where he stated that the brain code had been broken, the genetic code of the human brain, by the Soviets. He stated that the brain used 11 independent frequency channels. There's some 20-some-odd in there all together. 11 of them are independent. And so if you have 11 independent channels and you control the modulations going on those channels, you can control anything and everything that goes in the brain, any kind of thinking, any kind of emotion, any kind of pictures, any kind of a visualization, whatever. If you control it, then Orwell's 1984 came just a little early, and you can do it by purely mechanical, electrical means. Next slide, please. This is the approach to coupling such a control system to the head. It is usable for a good fashion as well as bad. Any tool can be used either way. Let us hope we can find some extremely good uses for this, because if we can put the good material in there, or we can find what the bad material is and change it, we could certainly do a very great deal for people who are terribly crippled by things like schizophrenia, for example. We could do it directly, and we could also have a science at it instead of a long practice of something we hope will eventually be able to help the individual. We could certainly advance the therapy drastically. Now, what you do is you couple in a carrier, ordinary electromagnetic wave, and here I'm talking about 11 independent channels. And to do that, you'd have to have a basic carrier carrying them, you see. But each one of these 11 modulations or so is going to be your carrier, or for that channel, they're going to be a channel carrier. And then you're going to put the modulations that you really want to get in the brain on that. And you deliberately choose these to fit the 11 channels of the brain. And you couple them to the brain with a very simple fashion. You remember all the stuff that Al Bielik told you about the fact that the brain is modulated and is riding along about 10 hertz or lower, actually about 7.5 or so. If you come along with a 10 hertz modulation, which is impressed on 16 or 17 or 18 channels, and they're phase locked together, all of them are 10 hertz at the same phase, what you will do is you will capture the brain, and you will lock in all of those channels to the brain. And that's the way across the world you can lock in the necessary 11 independent channels into the human heads that are captured by the basic 10 hertz modulation to lock it to the heads of an entire or near entire population, depending on the strength. Right now you can get about 30% of them, increase the strength, you can get about 60-70%. When you do that, you can put anything into them you want, anything from violent fear, rage, total terror, total insanity, pictures and things that they don't know what's happening to them or whatever, and you can do it from half a world away. And that is the exact characteristics being demonstrated quite often by the Soviet woodpecker signals. Bob Beck has in fact directly seen and measured such a multiple phase lock 10 hertz modulation on 16 channels. That's 11 plus 5 extra for good measure. Next slide, please. I won't go further into the ramifications there. Draw your own conclusions. Here's the way it works. Put in good stuff, you get a happy smile on the person's face. Put in the bad stuff, you can do him in. Put in some of those disease patterns that they prove that can be taken from the diseased cells. Take in some of the death patterns. You can have a death weapon against an entire population par excellence. You could just as easy, for example, with this kind of system, put in an anti-cancer pattern. And about 50 to 60% of your population, you could be curing of cancer if they happen to have it with such a benign modulation. So it's usable for the good as well as the bad. The Priori device uses exactly that kind of mechanism in a localized field. It doesn't broadcast it around halfway around the world. It does it right in the lab. The Soviets have already put something like a 40 megawatt transmitter to transmit it around the Earth through the ionospheric potential with the Earth and ring that. And so that's the woodpecker signal. Next slide, please. I'm going to do a sharp right angle turn because I promised you I'd tell you something about human beings and where we're headed. And I'm going to condense it very quickly. From the condensation of the Earth, from the primeval whirl of the hot material, to the formation of the oceans, and then to the formation of the great lightning bolts and the methane and so forth, and the little cells eventually forming in the heat and so forth I told you about, let us move immediately to the formation of the supermolecules and then eventually to the living cell. Life is everywhere, everything's alive, so there's no mysterious thing here about condensing life. Spontaneous generation, my goodness, it's all alive anyway. We just induced or triggered a preference into it when it was non-preferentially before. At that point, then, shortly, we will have the rise of multicellular systems, and that's where you and I are. After a continued development for a long period of time from that, we are the highest form of multicellular life on Earth, at least on the surface of the Earth. Okay, there are two kinds of control of behavior in such a system. One is hardwired control. That's what we call instinct or genetic or whatever. You don't have time to learn to breathe. You die before you learn that skill, so you've got to be born able to breathe, and you've got to be born with your heart able to beat. On the other hand, if everything were absolutely mechanical or cataloged, the first time you met something that wasn't in your catalog, you would die. That would do you in. And so no animal can be totally programmed, and no animal can be totally deprogrammed. If you had everything available for learning behavior and didn't have anything conditioned, you'd die before you learned to beat your heart. So there's a mix of the two that's necessary. And we use the anthropological definition of intelligence, the ability to adapt, and all in the world that means is how much or to what degree you are unwired and available for learning. So we sit here on our two hind legs, patting ourselves on the back about how great we are, and the only thing our physical body is the mechanism that has seen fit to tear out a great number of the hardwired circuits, have a great deal available then for learning, and so we are what you call the most adaptive form of life on the surface of the planet. The highest intelligence means the most adaptive. Now, since we are intelligent, there are two kinds of intelligence that you can develop. One is you've got a wiggle thing here that you can grab something to manipulate tools. Tool using is technological, so we are a technological animal because we had to grab the limbs to get away from the big saber tooths. On the other hand, if you don't have such a grasping member, manipulative member, you develop a kind of intelligence like the dolphin, non-technological. And so the dolphin is probably our equal, or in some of them even our superior, underneath the Earth, but a totally different kind of intelligence from what we have. We are technological, which means we adapt tools into the use ourselves and in our own conflicts. Now, when you have animals in conflict within the same species, it's not exact, but by and largely, males, for example, of the same species normally don't kill each other in the conflict within the species. Normally, I said, not universally, but normally. Normally, for example, when male deers fight for territory, females, whatever, when one of them surrenders or weakens or shows a sign of surrender by showing the white tail as he moves away, the other animal does not pursue him and kill him. He stomps and snorts a little bit and all the anger goes away and that's it. It's not because he's benevolent at all. It's simply because he's hardwired. He's got a switch that when those things occur, bang, the switch gets thrown, all the anger's gone, that's it. Well, now you, man and woman, in your self-pride, patting yourself on the back about how superior you are and we are, must recognize that what we've really done is torn out the controls. You can't have it both ways. If you want to be intelligent and adaptive, you've got to loosen the controls, the hardwired controls. And that means you don't have the stop switches, not nearly like the deer does. And so when a man weakens in his conflict with another man and turns to flee, the other man is fully capable and quite often will chase him down and kill him. And it has nothing to do with morality. It has nothing to do with good and evil. It has to do with hardwired switches, whether they're present or not, and control of behavior. Now, if you wish to be intelligent, then your species must be its own self-killer if you're technological and adapt tubes. And that's where we are. Indeed, we are killer apes of the highest kind. But don't worry, it's going to be happy in the end. And so we adapt tools in our own internal conflict, and as our learning adaptation goes, the tools get more powerful and our conflict gets ever more hostile. The end result is a huge servo mechanism, or group of them, clashing and banging around within our species, out of control. The only thing can happen from such a system is it must destroy itself, or it must be controlled, ordered. And so that is the only two choices left to us. Right now it looks like we're about to destroy ourselves. Our tools have eventually got powerful enough to destroy the entire earth and everything in it. So what happens? Where do we go from here? What is the nature of the problem? The problem is we have to find some way to restore order without losing your freedom and without losing your intelligence. That's the fundamental human problem. Let's work on it and solve it. Here we go. Let's look at mind. Mind goes on into unconscious mind. That's just multiple perceptions at a time. Therefore, it's not conscious, not monocular, so it's not conscious. It's multiply conscious rather than singularly conscious. And so you can pull things out of the unconscious. That's why they're there. They are conscious, multiply conscious. And the nested levels go on down in the unconscious levels. There's a level for a family. There's a level for a territory, for everything else, on down to the whole human species. That's Jung's collective unconscious, and it is a mind. And you gain an extra dimension for every stage. And so the collective human unconscious mind is a great living entity which operates in about 4 billion dimensions. And you and I are all part of that. Now, next slide, please. If you keep going past the human species, you get all the species, you get all the worlds, you get God. You see, total consciousness is what we would call God, everything. Turn it around the other way. The total unconscious level, however, let's look at the characteristics of that great supermind of which we are all cells, that super being of which we are the cells. I call it Zarg because I get tired of the mouth-filling phrase, collective human unconscious mind. So let's talk about Zarg. First of all, it's totally unconscious. Wasn't that interesting? Multiply conscious. 4 billion dimensional. The other thing is that it largely, since it's 4 billion dimensional, it's got so many layers of virtual state in it, it is largely responsible for prescribing the so-called laws of nature and the type of physical reality we live in. We ourselves largely prescribe the reality we experience. It's not light. You can't change it just by changing your little conscious mind. It's the whole unconscious that establishes it, not just you and your own little individual unconscious and your own individual conscious mind. Okay, the other thing is, what about its conscious mind? Well, it's fragmented into 4 billion pieces, yours, 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 and mine, etc., etc. Now, in psychology, the fragmentation of the conscious mind technically is called dissociation. And technically, severe dissociation defines insanity, psychosis, severe psychosis. 4 billion fragmentations, the collective human unconscious is totally insane. There are three scenarios to do it. One, you can do it with the ordinary electromagnetic signals we're tying together the great population centers of Earth on, because mind stuff is carried in every photon and every charged particle that goes down a wire. And so a crude elementary nervous system for the whole human race is slowly being built on this planet. If we had another 50 to 100 years, we'd get it naturally that way. You wouldn't have to worry about it anyway if we could stay at peace. And it would gradually cohere. The Kundalini is slowly rising in the human race anyhow. It's getting easier to get paranormal phenomena, for example. However, we don't have 50 or 100 years, I'm convinced. The next way you can get it is if you were clever, like the dumb Cajun says, and you decide to do that yourself. And you take this multiple channel type neurophone approach, or the saying very similar to the woodpecker, and you simply start linking brains. How come you think you can do that, you dumb Cajun? Because you proved to me I can do that. The two cerebral halves in your head are known to be separate brains. And there are people who have those severed. The corpus callosum connects them together. And when those are severed, two personalities emerge in one body. If we seriously influence and stress the effect of the functioning of the conscious mind, we can cause it sometimes to separate into multiple personalities anyway in the same body. But we can get them in there at the same time by splitting the two brain halves apart. And of course, a lot of animal experiments have been done. When you do that, you have two beings, not one, in a single human body, and I'm talking about rigorous laboratory experiments. I'm not talking about mysticism. The corpus callosum proves conclusively two things. You can link beings into one being, and you can link brains into one higher brain. You are proof. You're carrying it around in your own head, and your own personality is so integrated. After all, each cell in your body is an independent life form with its independent little mind world, and it's its own little critter. It's just cohered by that virtual state control system. You're already living proof of exactly what I'm talking about. You are a psychotronic device, superb, par excellence, right where you sit. Let's just continue it. That's nature's plan. So let's continue what is natural. What's magic about the figure two? Nothing. Suppose you and I were linked. We're talking four now. Four brain hands. And we're talking some type of psychotronic communication system, not too different from the woodpecker signal. There would not be a you and I, there would be one greater I in each one of us, and you'd see in four dimensions. It would see in four dimensions. It would see an extra dimension from what we normally experience. What's magic about four? Nothing. How about 8 billion? If you link 100 people, you get into what is called the 100 monkey effect. At that point, the psychokinetic ability goes up exponentially as the number of stages. Take whatever Uri Geller can do, multiply it by 10 to the 100th, and that is what 100 linked people could do. They could dissolve reality. It could dissolve reality whenever it wished, because it's operating in 100 dimensions. We would not have war and all this stuff. You long since lost that when you went to the fifth dimension. You don't have all that terrible conflict anymore. Merely recovering the fourth dimension, you and I are exactly the same thing. You're a three-dimensional piece, I'm a three-dimensional piece. In the fourth dimension, we're hanging on the same clothesline right now. We're all one in this room and then on this planet, and in fact, in the entire universe. If we but knew it and could see, the photon interaction is what separates us from seeing it. And all I'm saying is that we build a device. We know there are devices which work around the photon interaction. We simply build one to get around the fundamental human limitation. This entity being 4 billion dimensions that emerges, next slide please, then what would you call something that had no physical limitations, no time limitations? We have no word. You might call it a god, meaning that it has overcome all normal limitations. You might prefer to call it an angel. Whatever it is, that is what you and I will become, because the third scenario, we get it by violence. The Soviets unleashed the great weapons they've developed in psychotronics. These constitute, previous slide please, these constitute, when they are unleashed in mass, gigantic bee stings directly into this great sleeping beast, the collective human unconscious, rousing it in great anger and shock, lashing its tail and gnashing its teeth. And it dissolves the very physical laws of nature we operate by. Yes, indeed, ladies and gentlemen, time does indeed stop. And you get the book of Revelation in the whole nine yards. But you get it in a very strange fashion, and I'm talking physics, not metaphysics or mysticism. And I promise you that that is what we are and where we are headed. And we've got 3 to 5 years. Until we recover our ultimate and true nature, which is Godhood, we will be, and you will be, each of us will become the all, it's holographic, we will be gods and one with God in our own holographic reality. Next slide, please. Skip that one on to the next one. It should be down to about the last one. This one just symbolizes the great linkage of humanity, which is to come right around the corner, 3 to 5 years. Next slide, please. That simply summarizes the lecture. I won't even take that because of time. Next slide, please. And my final slide shows a plea that science has not ended, knowledge has not ended, and the great barriers that have resisted all the philosophers and the logicians, the problem of good and evil, the problem of time, the problem of mind, all of these barriers yield to four-law logic and psychotronic physics. And my final plea is, let us simply get on with the new physics and with the new being. Thank you very much for your attention.